This BBC podcast is supported by ads outside the UK.
An Bord erwarten Sie Bars, Spa-Duschen sowie preisgekrönte Bordunterhaltung. Es ist also kein Wunder, dass Emirates als beste Fluggesellschaft der Welt ausgezeichnet wurde. Wir fliegen Sie zu über 140 Reisezielen. Und mit unseren Interline-Partnern weltweit bieten wir Ihnen Anschlussflüge zu weiteren 1700 Städten auf 6 Kontinenten. Wenn wir behaupten, dass wir eine der größten internationalen Fluggesellschaften sind, meinen wir, wir bringen Sie an Ihr Wunschziel. Jetzt buchen auf emirates.de. Fly Emirates, fly better.
The following feature is paid and presented by the Department for Business and Trade. Welcome to the United Kingdom, where the brightest tech innovators reshaping our world are celebrated. This year, the Department for Business and Trade are spotlighting global, trailblazing entrepreneurs through the Unicorn Kingdom Pathfinder Awards. The winner of the Connected and Automated Mobility Technology category was Batobo. Hear from the co-founder, Sanjag Gulgan.
The main idea in the warehouses to move your products as quickly as possible and accurately. We are trying to optimize operations, robots actually walking around the warehouses. They can run 3 shifts, so they can run 24/7. And also we have a chance to meet the demand for the rapid growth in trading. I'm excited to grow the Batobo in the UK. We can access any institutions and technical resources. We can apply more patents here, which is very critical for the valuation for the future existence. It's easy to expand your business here and set up a company here. So this is a very big advantage. This is a very good opportunity in the UK. Whatever you touch, you see some opportunity and benefits here.
From cutting-edge AI to digital trade solutions, these innovators are building tomorrow's world today. Learn how the United Kingdom supports tech pioneers at great.gov.uk/UKPA.
Hello and welcome to World Business Report on the BBC World Service. Will Bain with you again today. Thanks for being back with us. Coming up on the programme, the battle to boost defence spending in Europe in the face of Russia's aggression in Ukraine. We hear exclusively from one European Union defence minister and why he feels it's imperative European countries continue to spend more on defence.
This was the decision we made together. And that means that, you know, one for all for one principle is valid.
Also today, we get a perspective on why China's response to US tariffs seems perhaps more muted than during the first Trump presidency. And we look at why Germany has one of the most generous sick pay policies in the world.
I think I needed 2 weeks sick last year, but it was no big deal.
And finally today, can you speak Simglish? Yeah, we're going to mark 25 years of one of the best-selling video games of all time, The Sims. I know it's a big favourite in the studio today, big favourite in our house at home. Is it a big favourite for you growing up as well? Have you had any of the additions over the previous 25 years? You can get in touch with us about that or anything else you hear over the next half hour here on World Business Report by getting in touch on our WhatsApp number. It's +44 330 678 3033. Well, that's come, as I say, before we leave you here today on WBR. But let's start, though, in Europe. And ever since Russia's full-scale invasion of Ukraine in 2022, there's been increasing questions about whether countries are spending enough on their armed forces. There's been pressure, too. President Trump has been a vocal in his impression that too many members of the NATO military alliance simply rely on America's military might and spending. And he's challenged members, as a result, to commit to spending 5% of their GDP. That's the value of all the goods and services in their economy, on defence.
I'm also going to ask all NATO nations to increase defence spending to 5% of GDP, which is what it should have been years ago. It was only at 2%, and most nations didn't pay until I came along. I insisted that they pay, and they did.
At a summit in the Belgian capital, Brussels, this week, the home of NATO headquarters, of course, European leaders have been meeting to discuss just this. Here's the president of the European Commission, Ursula von der Leyen, speaking after talks on Monday.
For extraordinary times, it is possible to have extraordinary measures. So we will look as a commission deeper into using much more flexibilities for defence investment and defence expenditures.
Well, one country that says it plans to meet the pledge is the Eastern European nation of Estonia. It shares its eastern border with Russia and recently announced that, along with Lithuania, it would spend 5% of its GDP on defence. We asked the country's defence minister, Hanno Pevkur, how they plan to meet that commitment and over what kind of timescale.
We agreed together with all the allies that we have new regional plans for the defence of the alliance. And at the moment, we are in the discussions to approve also the new capability targets. And when we take these capability targets and look at what the countries have to do, then the reality is that 2% is not enough when you talk about defense spendings. Now, depending the country, it may vary, but the reality is that most of the countries have to invest more, maybe some 3.5, maybe some 4, maybe some 5. But the reality is that in most of the countries, it has to grow significantly.
And it's a commitment right now. What is the timescale for that commitment? When will you reach spending of 5% of your GDP on defence?
I also looked into the history, and then when I take the time Estonia spent in NATO as a full member of NATO since 2004, then since 2004 to 2024, in 21 years, our defence spending by average has been actually 2%. Mm. So starting from 2022, we started to increase our defence spending after the full-scale war started. And last year we had around 3.4, this year around the same. Next year we will go to 3.7. But as was mentioned, we are discussing at the moment that we maybe can speed up this process. And definitely the 5% target is not something which goes beyond 5 years or to 10 years. It's rather quick. Will it be in a couple of years? Will it be in 3-4 years? We have to negotiate that on the governmental and parliament in the upcoming months.
Yeah, and presumably those negotiations are about choices, right? What choices have you already, because as you say, it's been quite a ratcheting up already in the past few years of what you're spending, committing to defence. What choices has that meant in terms of where you're shifting public spending away from and how difficult have some of those choices been?
We all understand that, you know, the choices are hard, but the reality is that even spending 5% for defence is less than what we see today in Ukraine. Ukraine is spending approximately 30% of their GDP annually to defend the country. So we all understand that keeping and preserving the peace with 5% is still less than to have the full-scale war. So, of course, we understand that it is a burden for society. And in Estonian case, we had to increase taxes. So basically, we introduced the security tax, which consists from three components. One is 2% additional income tax, one is 2% additional VAT, and one is 2% of the profits of for the companies. So this is the what we had to do. Of course, also we had to shift some understandings in the budget. But nevertheless, the point is that in the last 3 years, we've doubled in digits our defence spending.
Presumably there's a limit on that, though, how much tax people are going to be willing to pay going forward.
Well, there is always a limit, but one is to preserve the peace and to live in peace, and the other is to fight for your own country during the war. We all understand that there are limits and it's not easy, but we try to be very open to our society and we try to explain why do we need to increase the defence spendings and what all the allies also have to do in order to preserve the peace.
Well, I wanted to ask you exactly that. When you're doing that explanation to Estonians paying more tax or businesses in Estonia paying more tax, what do you say to them when partners, allies in theory in the European Union, Italy, Spain, Slovenia, Portugal, all paying nowhere near 2% in terms of their GDP on defence?
Well, of course, when we take the numbers, then, you know, closer you are to Russia, the higher are the spendings. But we also do believe that, you know, our allies will have more and more information what it means to be in the war and what it means.
Do you think they should step up, though?
Everyone should do that because this was the joint decision. This was the decision we made together that 2% is absolute minimum. We agreed together that we have new regional plans, and now we are making the decision together to approve the new capability targets. And when the capability targets are approved jointly, then that means that everybody will sign that, not maybe physically, but sign that decision. And that means that, you know, one for all for one principle is valid also in Spain as it is in Estonia.
Because I guess seeing what we're seeing on the day that we're speaking, Minister, as well, around tariffs from the United States and President Trump saying he is certain to levy tariffs against the European Union going forward. I guess we're in a new era here where Europe perhaps needs to look after itself, work together better than it has before, because America can't be relied on in the same way as before.
Well, the reality is, and it has been, unfortunately, for the last 30 years that, you know, Europe didn't invest enough to defense. Because, you know, when you take 40 years back, then during the Cold War, defense spendings in European countries were close to 4%. So when we were able to invest into defense during the Cold War, without any war in Europe, around 3 to 4%. So why can't we do it again? And, you know, the understanding that since the collapse of the Soviet Union, the European countries stopped investing into defense, this time is over, and there is a need to invest more. Then, you know, my simple question is that when we were able to do that in the 80s without any war, then why can't we do it again? Because we see that Russia is hostile towards its neighbors, and a lot of neighbors of Russia are also the members of the alliance.
Can Europeans do that, though, step up, ramp up that spending in the way you have in Estonia or your colleagues in Lithuania have, at the same time that a supposed ally is ratcheting up basically economic warfare on the other side in terms of tariffs?
Well, I believe that, you know, nobody would like to see tariffs. And personally, I am a strong believer of the free economy and the economical trade. And I truly believe that US and Europe need each other. And the free economy between us is something which gives the economical growth, gives the richness, and gives the, you know, the better life for our people. This is what should drive us. The free trade, free movement of people, and all what binds us more together helps us more than things what divide us.
That's Estonia's Defence Minister Hanno Pevkur there, and on tariffs, a response in the last half an hour or so from the European Union's Trade Chief Maros Sefcovic, speaking in Warsaw to the BBC's Sarah Rainsford about those potential US tariffs on EU goods, saying we'll be constructive, but if we feel we are hit unfairly and in an arbitrary manner by tariffs, then we will react firmly. Similarly on tariffs, news coming down on the news wires as well that Presidents Trump and Xi look like they're going to speak at some point on Tuesday on the phone. A lot then for the markets to digest, and Fiona Sincotta is going to try and do that for us here on the programme. Fiona, of course, the senior market analyst at City Index here in London. Fiona, great to have you on the programme as always.
Thank you.
It looks like a calmer kind of day on financial markets. Is that because of the pause on those Mexican and Canadian tariffs for a month that we heard about overnight with the team on Business Matters? Or is that because they've remembered how to do this with President Trump?
Yeah, that's a very good point. No, but you know, I think we are, you're right, we are seeing a bit of a recovery after really steep losses yesterday and a lot of volatility. And I think the fact that we have seen those pauses on Canada and Mexico just sort of serves as a notice to the markets that maybe this is a negotiation tactic as well, not just sort of going straight in with hard tariffs and nothing else. So that's given a bit of optimism to the market. I mean, we've seen a recovery, but we are seeing gold, which is a safe haven asset, trading at record highs. So I think that just reflects the level of uncertainty and unpredictability there is in the market.
And we've seen again today, we talked about car companies yesterday, today, big booze maker Diageo, owner of Guinness and Johnny Walker whiskey, it had some warnings about its sales guidance. We're still hearing from individual companies too impacted in all of this.
That's right. So we heard from Diageo, they're trading lower today. Again, they've scrapped basically their long-standing growth target and have blamed the uncertainty over US tariffs for it. The CFO actually warned of a potential $200 million hit to operating profits if the tariffs on Canada and Mexico go through. So there are certain companies that really are in the firing line.
More from Fiona to come, but country that we've not mentioned yet, though, is China, and they've announced retaliatory tariffs for the ones that are still going ahead from President Trump. 10% on all Chinese imports to the US. The countermeasure, 15% tax on things like coal, liquefied natural gas, some agricultural machinery, pickup trucks, large engine cars, all set to face 10% tariffs coming into force from next Monday. China's also put a complaint to the World Trade Organization. A little earlier, we tried to work out a bit more about what we learned from the Chinese response from Dr. Zhe Ye of the Chatham House International Affairs think tank here in the UK.
China's response, it seems to be less panic compared with the first round of trade war, firstly, as Chinese anticipated this quite a while ago. And secondly, I think China's countermeasure is quite targeted. The critical minerals, which China does enjoy monopoly and want to hit very hard on the American high-tech sector. These are the two things what we've known so far. Now, secondly, really judging from the words from Donald Trump, that we also realize that might be a possible phone call between President Trump and President Xi. And we might expect some kind of deal that would happen. It might happen, it may not happen. It really depends on how well they'll be able to talk to each other.
Yeah, talk to us about those critical minerals and those rare earth minerals, because they weren't kind of as directly mentioned as the new tariffs, but actually they're possibly the more significant thing that the two men might discuss, right? Because they're so critical in everything like microchips and semiconductors, all that kind of stuff.
Well, it's so critical, but I think there's also a very strong signal that sent it to the United States that firstly, China is not back down. China will not look soft. But secondly, China also wants to signal that how much damage that Beijing can do by imposing export restrictions on critical minerals.
What about in terms of the moves towards Google? Thought that was interesting too. This is more to do with the Android operating system rather than the company selling services, right? That is an interesting change of direction rather than a sort of physical tariff on a product, a sort of range of investigations against a big flagship US company.
So I think what Beijing wants to signal regarding the investigation with Google is just really to persuade the big tech companies in the United States and try to advocate on behalf of Beijing that persuade Donald Trump to not imposing further tariffs towards China. So I think that's the reason and rationale behind investigating towards Google.
President Xi has been, in the run-up to kind of a second Trump presidency, been keenly stressing, hasn't he, repeatedly over and over again, and other senior Chinese officials, that there's room for both in the world, that it doesn't have to be one or the other, that they should show more respect for each other, give each other that space. Do you think they can find a working relationship like that in those discussions that you were mentioning, rather than the tit for tat, you sanction, we sanction, you sanction, we sanction, that we saw during the first Trump presidency?
Well, I think this also largely depends on how China's domestic economic situation evolves. I mean, so far, really compared with the first round of the trade war, that China's economic condition is not as conducive that China is able to utilize all kind of retaliatory measures against the United States. So in that sense, China's toolbox for this time is limited compared with the past round of the trade war. So even if the two sides were through word on words against each other, I think both sides would know how much damage that trade war will do to each other. Hence, we'll hear a lot of word on words, but perhaps less regarding the actual and very heavy-handed measures.
Our thanks to Dr. Zhe Ye there.
An Bord erwarten Sie Bars, Spa-Duschen sowie preisgekrönte Bordunterhaltung. Es ist also kein Wunder, dass Emirates als beste Fluggesellschaft der Welt ausgezeichnet wurde. Wir fliegen Sie zu über 140 Reisezielen. Und mit unseren Interline-Partnern weltweit bieten wir Ihnen Anschlussflüge zu weiteren 1700 Städten auf 6 Kontinenten. Wenn wir behaupten, dass wir eine der größten internationalen Fluggesellschaften sind, meinen wir, wir bringen Sie an Ihr Wunschziel. Jetzt buchen auf emirates.de. Fly Emirates, fly better.
You're with World Business Report on the BBC World Service. And now Germany has one of the most generous sick leave policies in the world. The average employee, as a result, takes 20 days off sick each year. And it could be having an impact on the German economy. So says economists at the German Association of Pharmaceutical Companies. They believe the country wouldn't be in recession, in fact, if its workers had taken fewer days off. Hannah Mullane has been trying to find out what's going on.
It's 8 a.m. in Berlin, Germany's capital city. Commuters busily making their way to the office. But how would these workers feel if they needed to take time off sick?
My name is Mariana. I work as a production designer. It was actually always quite easy to take a sick leave, and I think people were kind of just doing it quite a lot. Burnout was quite a common thing.
My name is Dennis, and I'm a copywriter in an agency. I think we have a quite fair policy for the employees. I don't have to feel bad if I feel sick. I don't have to feel bad if my kids are sick.
My name is Julia and I'm a trainee for a company that works for the German pensions. I think I needed 2 weeks sick last year, but it was no big deal. Where I worked before, I think it was an issue, but at this kind of company, no. We have so much employees.
Germany's generous sick leave policy means you can take 6 weeks off at full pay, paid for by your employer. After that, your health insurance will pay 70% of your salary for the next 18 months. But what does such a generous policy mean for the economy? Nicola Seabath is Professor of Economics at the University of Mannheim and the Centre for European Economic Research.
There's no doubt that the sick pay system is a burden on the economy, especially in crisis times like now. We have a huge shortage of workers already. And you can imagine if in addition to, let's say, 30 days of vacation, we have a very generous parental leave system. Now people take more than 20 days of sick leave a year. That is a huge burden, not just in companies on their labor costs, but also in consumers and people not getting services delivered when they need it.
And it's a burden that's very much on the employer, having to pay workers for up to 6 weeks whilst they're not working. So how do they manage?
I think it's just baked in. I think it's in a similar situation as you assume that obviously everybody has 30 days of vacation and you just bake this in into the overall structure.
Stefan is the CEO of software company SDA and employs around 40 people. For him, the flexible working policy that came in during the pandemic is helping him manage when staff are off sick.
What I see is that people are, first they say, hey, I will be working from home because I feel a little bit under the weather. And I think this is quite good because previous to that, people would be a little bit sick, come to the office, and then you would have a lot of sick people. So that's better. And you also see more flexibility around this, I would say. Also, sick leave is also part sometimes if your child is sick and then people need to stay home to take care of the child. A lot of people say, hey, my child is sick, I cannot come to the office, I need to be at home, but I'm still able to work.
But if you're a much smaller business, how do you cope?
I'm Henry van Wagenberg. I'm one of the CEOs of Baugarden, the math and science world-building game. And we have 7 employees in our little team. If one employee is sick at Baugarden, we definitely feel it. It can ricochet through the rest of the team.
Henry's small team find it harder to manage sickness. But can he see the policy changing?
Yes, I could see it as something that could change. I do think that while it could change, it is also a deep part of the work culture right now. It wouldn't just be a policy change, it would be a cultural change.
Making any changes to the country's sick leave policy would certainly be unpopular with workers. But Germany is soon to hold a general election. And will the new government, with a struggling economy, feel the pressure to make some changes? We'll have to wait and see.
Hannah Mullane reporting there. If you want to hear a bit more about that, the Biz Daily podcast is the place to head to. Just search for Business Daily. Oh, well, you know where to get a podcast from at this point, don't you? Let's return to the markets. And Fiona Sincotta, senior market analyst at City Index, still with us. And Fiona, sort of good news, bad news stories on the markets today. You can pick which order you want to do them in. Spotify, extraordinarily strong numbers on the good side. And Nintendo looks like it needs a successor to its Switch console. Some pretty poor numbers from it today.
Yes, that's right. So just kicking off on the downside with Nintendo, really, as you mentioned, they revised annual earnings and Switch console sales lower after reporting weak results. They basically reported a 42% fall in net profits and revenues down 31%. And basically, this comes back to the Switch, which launched in 2017, and sales have slowed and declined quite considerably because 2017, in technology terms, that's quite a long time ago, so really need an update there. And then Spotify, great news, up around 8% after it's posted its first fully profitable year. It's seen really strong subscriber growth, low churn rates, despite seeing price rises. So that's really good news. Monthly active users rose by 35 million, so well above expectations, topping it at 675 million.
Yes, yeah, so seems to be in a really competitive space. Lots of people questioned whether it had the kind of financial firepower to meet some of the really deep pockets of an Apple or an Amazon in that space, certainly proving that it's been resilient there, hasn't it, as well? In terms of the world of video games, Fiona, were you ever a Sims player, or were there Sims players in the Sincotta household?
No, I just missed that one, I think.
I know Amy, our studio director today, was an expert. And if you're very lucky, before we squeeze it in before the end, she had a good cheat that maybe we will or won't tell you about, having maximum amounts of money to spend to build your house and keep your virtual Sims happy. Yeah, because the hit game 25 on Tuesday, it turned amazingly extraordinary, certainly aging me and many of the rest of you, I'm sure, listening. Since its release in 2000 on this day, sold nearly 200 million copies, making it one of the best-selling video game series of all time. The BBC's Laura Kress has been taking a look at why it stood the test of time.
So.
That's hello in Simlish, the made-up language of the hugely popular video game series The Sims. This February marks the 25th anniversary of the life simulation game, where players design their own characters, give them personalities, and keep them happy. Well, try to, at least. Since its original 2000 release, the series has become a genuine cultural phenomenon, with Barbie star Margot Robbie set to produce a movie inspired by the universe, and pop stars including Katy Perry recording songs in Simlish.
Yarby Denzel Table Goops, Ibi Duka Mimi Shoops, Hippy Kipsy Upper Goop.
Whilst creators Maxis and publishers EA are based in the US, it has a global fan base. The latest game, The Sims 4, has been translated into 18 different languages, including Russian, Chinese, and Danish. So why is the series still going strong after all these years?
Hi everyone, it's the English Simmer here, and welcome back to another...
Molly, a British content creator, is known as the English Simmer online. A Simmer is a super fan of the game. Think like Taylor Swift's Swifties, but for The Sims. She says the series' success springs from its open-ended gameplay and the willingness of developers to let players mod or modify its code to create whatever they want.
We have these amazing storytellers and just so much talent within the community to drive this game to be as open-ended as you really want it to be and wherever your imagination will take you.
Even at its launch, The Sims was a little different to other games at the time, where choices around sexuality or identity were rare. Players could pursue same-sex relationships. Later, options around gender and race opened up too. Amira is an American content creator who plays The Sims for a living. She created a darker skin tone pack for characters in the game.
One common issue in a lot of video games is that the skin tone options don't get as dark as they should, but the difference between a lot of games and The Sims is I can do something about it.
The games also come under some criticism for its lack of accessibility options for disabled people. But for the most part, The Sims' depth of customization is what continues to attract a diverse crowd of gamers.
That's a big part of why I play the game for so long. I can do what I want. I can make a sim with any body type, complexion, hair, whatever I want to do. It's like one of the most customizable games that I have.
Diversity in and outside of video games is currently under some scrutiny in America's political landscape. Companies such as Amazon and Meta, which owns social media apps Facebook and Instagram, have scaled back on their diversity programs as Donald Trump, who's long campaigned against such policies, has returned as president. What does this mean for the inclusive spaces in gaming? Zoe Delahunty-Light is a video producer for the British gaming website Eurogamer.
While it's unlikely The Sims publisher, EA, will follow Meta and suddenly change its inclusive options in The Sims, the bigger concern is that Meta changing its DEI principles will galvanize certain toxic groups of gamers to become more open about their own hateful views.
25 years on from its release, it's clear that for some players, The Sims has become that space. For these players, it's more than just a game. It's now a place for community, a place for simmers.
The BBC's Laura Kress reporting there, professional Sims player. I think my Sims always used to spend a lot of time getting wet. I could never put the roof on in time before it rained again there. If you were in the same bag as me, doubt we're going to become simmers. Amy, our studio director today, definitely is our simmer on the team. Big thanks to her. Big thanks to Craig, who's been producing the programme, and to James as well. And of course, to all of you for listening to World Business Report. Remember, the podcast is always available. Just search for it wherever you get yours from.
An Bord erwarten Sie Bars, Spa-Duschen sowie preisgekrönte Bordunterhaltung. Es ist also kein Wunder, dass Emirates als beste Fluggesellschaft der Welt ausgezeichnet wurde. Wir fliegen Sie zu über 140 Reisezielen. Und mit unseren Interline-Partnern weltweit bieten wir Ihnen Anschlussflüge zu weiteren 1700 Städten auf 6 Kontinenten. Wenn wir behaupten, dass wir eine der größten internationalen Fluggesellschaften sind, meinen wir bringen Sie an Ihr Wunschziel. Jetzt buchen auf emirates.de. Fly Emirates, fly better.